everyone should have received a handout as they come in the door. If you have not received one, if you'd please raise your hand, we'll see that you get one. Brother Wesley Kramer has chosen for his subject this morning the Silver Trumpets. The hymn no doubt gave you a clue. Now we're happy to turn the meeting over to Brother Wesley. The Silver Trumpets.
Thank you, Brother Allen. Good morning, dear friends. It's indeed a pleasure for Sister Tony and I to be with you in convention. And we heartily bring you the loving greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, only a few of which are here, but they're all with you here in spirit. As Brother Allen has announced, our subject for consideration this morning is the Silver Trumpets. Undoubtedly, there have been many literal trumpets made by men over the years, and there have been many sounds which have emanated from those trumpets throughout many lands. And they've been a delight to all the ears, undoubtedly, that have heard them. But of all the beautiful trumpets ever made, and of all the beautiful sounds that have emanated forth, and of all the lands that these sounds have emanated through, we believe that no trumpet has been more beautiful. No trumpets have been more significant, more far-reaching, more penetrating, more important than the trumpets prefigured for us in Leviticus, the 25th chapter, verse 9, which we would like to read. Leviticus 25:9. And thou shalt cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, in the Day of Atonement. Shall you make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. Friends, we believe that the trumpets prefigured in Leviticus, the 25th chapter, are now sounding, that they have been sounding for over 100 years, and that they will continue to sound in all of their radiance and all of their beauty and all of their power for approximately another 900 years. Friends, we speak of the antitypical Jubilee trumpets, the times of restitution of all things. Let's define our purpose for the next hour or so. Our purpose, really, is to review with you five important points that we think are essential to an understanding of the times of restitution. And we've outlined these on your handout, which hopefully you have by now. These five major points, we might note, are the five points that we feel are the five main points in Chapter 6 of Volume 2 of Studies in the Scriptures. So in essence, you might think of our remarks as a proposed, an offering of what we feel are the five major points found in that particular chapter. We won't take the time to read them because we'll be going through them one by one. But let's take a look at the first one. Point number one. We think in order to properly understand the times of restitution, that there has to be a recognition and there has to be an understanding of some essential rules regarding types and antitypes. We're going to go over these quickly because they're found on your handout. We're not going to read the scriptures. We have much material to cover, and by His grace we're going to try to get through it. But each one of these rules is going to come into play throughout our remarks, so our comments on them will be very brief. Rule number one, the only thing that is a type is that which is scripturally authorized as such. For example, we find that God's dealings with the nation of Israel were of a typical character, not because we imagine it so, but because we specifically find direction in the scriptures that it is so, particularly the Apostle Paul gives us the direction that God's dealings with Israel were of a typical character. Rule 2, no type will go unfulfilled. In every case, the reality is going to displace the type in God's due time and in his due way. Rule 3, repeating a type is not the fulfilling of a type. They're not the same. No matter how many times that a type was repeated, the repeating of the type did not constitute the fulfillment of that type. Rule 4. Where time is an important feature of a type, once the type ceases, the antitype must at least begin its fulfillment immediately. Once again, we think that this rule is clearly contained in Matthew 5:18, which you'll find cited on just about every one of those rules, I think, except the first one. With the use of the word till all be fulfilled. We think the use of the word till, the inclusion of the word till, suggests that there's time involved, and that once the type ceases, the reality must at least commence in some way in the case where time is an important feature of a particular type. Rule number 5, the law that God gave to Israel is an authorized type. Jesus and the apostles as well suggest that the law that God gave to Israel through Moses was designed to foreshadow good things to come. And hence we think there's specific direction that he was suggesting that the law is a type. Rule number 6, where time is an important feature of a type, the antitype never follows the type, but rather it replaces it on the same day. Once again, this is where time is an important feature of a particular type. This rule was probably most forcefully taught in the type of the Passover lamb. And we recall with what care and what particularity God was sure to carefully organize things so that Jesus, our true Passover lamb, died on the same day, on the same date, Nisan the 14th, as the typical lamb had died year after year. It wasn't a day earlier, it wasn't a day later. Jesus died on Nisan the 14th. With these 6 basic rules in mind, let's continue our subject of looking at actually the second point, which is on your outline. A fundamental basis for our belief in the times of restitution is found in the 25th chapter of Leviticus. In reviewing this chapter, we can't help but see that there are 2 distinct sets of details that are given to us. The one set deals with the character features of the Jubilee law, what was to actually happen during the Jubilee year. But the other set of details that are given to us deal with the time regulations, the time features of governing precisely the beginning, the length, and the ending of the typical Jubilee year, as well as the lesser Sabbaths. We propose to show that both of these sets of details, the character features, the time features, each have an antitypical, a profound antitypical significance. So let's begin our examination with taking a look at the character features. What actually happened during, or what was to happen, I should say, during that year. A reading of the 25th chapter of Leviticus reveals that, legally speaking, the Jubilee law was to operate to benefit the children of Israel in chiefly 5 ways. And knowing that the law was expressly designed to foreshadow good things to come, let's consider these 5 in some detail and see what is suggested and see what other scriptures are in harmony by what is suggested thereby. Let's take the first 2 together. Release from bondage or personal liberty, and the second one, release from old debts. 40 years after the children of Israel left Egypt, they entered Canaan. And during the next 6 years, the land was conquered and divided amongst the tribes of Israel, except, of course, the tribe of Levi. Each family received a tract of farmland upon which it depended for its temporal sustenance. But apparently, through mismanagement, honest mistakes of judgment, and other reasons, some families got themselves apparently so deeply in debt that they were forced to sell their precious land upon which they depended, and they became servants of others. And we learn of this service arrangement in verses 35 to 40. Once again, whenever we refer to verses, unless we otherwise state, they'll be to the 25th chapter of Leviticus. But fortunately, this service arrangement lasted only until the next Jubilee year, because the law was clear that the debts, as well as the servitude, were legally finished once the Jubilee trumpet sounded. And this arrangement, we think that we see a grand illustration of what the whole world of mankind has gotten themselves into, as well as the unspeakable blessing that lies in store. Mankind, through sin, has been indebted and hence enslaved to sin and to death. Paul says in Romans chapter 7 that men are, quote, sold in sin, unquote. That is, they are slaves of sin. And he further says in Romans chapter 5, verse 12, that death passed upon all men. That is, men are slaves of death. But fortunately, man has a liberator, Christ the Redeemer, who has already provided the necessary ransom to buy back all of the slaves. And just as we are assured that he has provided the redemption price, we are equally assured that it will be applied during the times of restitution to bring about the full liberty of the captives. Man's debts will be fully paid, and he will enjoy the fullest liberty from sin and death in all of its forms. Indeed, the ransomed of the Lord shall return with songs and with everlasting joy upon their heads. No more servitude, no more debts. Let's take a look at the third feature, families restored. Apparently, when the children of Israel became indebted and sold their land and became servants, their families were often split up. Some went here and some went there to serve until the year of Jubilee. And we're impliedly told of this arrangement in verses 10 and 41. But clearly, the sounding of the Jubilee trumpets entitled the scattered ones to reunite to their loved ones. Once again, a beautiful antitypical lesson, we believe, shines forth as bright as the noonday sun. Prior to his disobedience, Adam was a son of God, as we're told in Luke, the third chapter. And he enjoyed wonderful fellowship as well as divine care and supervision. But you know, Adam's sin ended all of that. And he alienated not only himself, but he alienated all of his progeny from God. And subsequent years have witnessed not only a pronounced alienation of the human family from God and his righteousness, but the members of the human family have become deeply alienated from one another. You know, it really isn't much of a family anymore when you look at the human race. If you see all the wars and the hatred and the fraud and the like, even between the closest members of the human family, of the human race, all these things witness that barely a trifle of real family fellowship and love remains. But the antitypical Jubilee, the Jubilee of restitution, is going to witness a drastic change to all that. The human family is going to be completely reunited with itself. Once they're brought up the highway of holiness and their characters conform perfectly to the character of Christ, the grand family reunion will be well underway. The joy is going to be unspeakable, and the joy will never cease. Friends, the human race is going to be a family again. But that's not the full extent of the family reunion. Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, that everything in heaven and in earth will be reunited. Men will be reunited not only with themselves, but they're also going to be reunited in heart fellowship with the holy angels, with God, with Jesus, with the church. Friends, everything and everyone will be reunited in heart. It'll be a family reunion of family reunions. The fourth character feature of the Jubilee is set forth in verses 10, 13, and 41. The return of the possessions that had been lost. Undoubtedly, as we've mentioned earlier, the main possession that was returned was undoubtedly the land. But undoubtedly it probably included other things as well, such as farming implements and other things that they may have lost. But what possible antitypical lesson could this teach? Well, when Adam was created, he was created perfect. And he was crowned with glory, and he was crowned with honor. And he was imbued with the mental and the moral qualities of his Creator. And additionally, God gave man dominion over the beasts and over the fowl and over the fish and indeed over all the works of his hands, as we read of in Psalms, the 8th chapter. But the fall of man has effaced all, or nearly all, of these, quote-unquote, these personal possessions. You know, man no longer has much of an ability to reason accurately or to remember acutely or to love deeply. And he's far from being physically perfect. And you know, he really doesn't have much in the way of true dominion over the works of creation. But the times of restitution, friends, are going to witness a change to all that. They're going to witness a full return of all these personal possessions. Just as the Israelites obtained the return of their priceless land and their other possessions in the year of Jubilee, man is going to receive personal perfection and beauty. We read in Job, the 33rd chapter, that his flesh is going to be younger than a child's. And his full mental and moral qualities, we believe as well, are going to be returned to him, as well as true dominion over the works of creation. Feature number 5, the rest for the land. The fifth feature of the Jubilee law was that it was to be a period of rest for the land. We read of this in verses 11 and 12. And they make it quite clear to us that no crops were to be sown or harvested during this year. In fact, we get the impression that the Israelites were not even permitted to reap what grew by itself during the Jubilee year. We get the impression that it was to be a very, very complete rest for the land during the year. And the Israelites were to live on the increase or the produce stored up from prior years. Once again, we think that a beautiful antitypical lesson shines forth from this fifth character feature of the Jubilee law. At the time of Adam's fall, the earth, except for one small spot, was still unfinished. It was still incomplete. And Father Adam's sin brought a curse upon the earth. And the perfecting process that we believe that had started in the Garden of Eden was quickly brought to a halt. But even worse, mankind, because of his selfishness, began perpetrating gross abuses upon the earth. And we see these today when we look around. Unreclaimed coal stripping operations and timbering operations, massive forest fires, billions of tons of pollutants pumped into our air, our waters, our lakes and streams, and so on. All these and countless others have placed an incredible strain upon the earth itself. But Earth's Great Jubilee is going to witness a change to all that as well. But even more, not only will the existing abuses be halted and reversed and new ones prevented, but the entire earth is going to be brought forth in perfection in all of its glory and all of its beauty. We catch a glimpse of this in Isaiah, the 35th chapter. The desert shall blossom as a rose. Waters shall break out in the wilderness, and the parched ground shall become a pool. Isaiah also writes in Isaiah, the 60th chapter, that the earth, which is God's footstool, shall be made glorious. How beautiful, then, does the Jubilee law foreshadow earth receiving her full rest from imperfection and incompletion. So if we take a look at the panoramic view of all five character features of the Jubilee Law, it clearly pictures that indeed we're overwhelmed with the comprehensiveness of the restitution that is pictured there. The Jubilee Law pictures the restitution not just of a couple things, not just of a few things, not just of many things. Friends, the Jubilee Law pictures the restitution of all things. But as awe-stricken as we are with looking at the character features of the Jubilee Law, you know, it's really only half the story. Up to this point, we have purposely avoided talking about the time features of the Jubilee Law. And we've done this because we want to draw a clear distinction between the character features and the time features so that we can clearly see the antitypical significance of each. And we thought by clearly separating them, perhaps our focus could be more fully drawn to them. So let's now take a look at the time features of the Jubilee Law and see what this has in store for us. Verses 1 and 2 and also 8 to 10 clearly reveal that every 50th year from the time that the Israelites entered Canaan was to be a Jubilee year. But in order to comprehend, we believe, the antitypical significance of the time feature of this particular time feature of the Jubilee Law, we think that we've got to look at Israel's lesser Sabbaths and their manner of reckoning as well. So let's start with Exodus, the 31st chapter. In Exodus 31:15, we find that the Jews are enjoined to rest every seventh day of the week. And we find in Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, that once every year, on the 50th day, calculated from the 16th day of Nisan, the Sabbath days reached a climax. And this climax was known as the Day of Pentecost, or the Day of Jubilee. And it was calculated by multiplying seven Sabbath days by the equal number of seven. This yields seven cycles, which constitutes 49 literal days. And the following day, the 50th day, was the Day of Pentecost. Next, the Jews were required to keep a Sabbath every seventh year, as we clearly find recorded in the verses 1 through 4. And these Sabbath years climax in the same way as the Jubilee Day. Seven Sabbath years multiplied by the equal number of seven gives us seven cycles, which constitutes 49 years, and the following year was the year of Jubilee, the 50th year. Hence, we see by looking at the Sabbath days as well as the Sabbath years, we find that God has clearly revealed to us a priceless pattern. The chief Sabbath day as well as the chief Sabbath year were both reached by squaring the lesser Sabbaths, respectively. And the product of this squaring brought us to the climactic, or the chief Sabbath, in both cases. So let's now turn to the antitype with this background in mind. Since we know that Israel's Jubilee year is a type, and that it pictures something much grander, we think that we can properly say from this perspective that the typical Jubilee year is the lesser Sabbath. The typical Jubilee year is the lesser Sabbath in relationship to the antitypical Jubilee, which we believe is the chief Sabbath. And we think that by following the same pattern of squaring the lesser Sabbath, that we should find the length of the great antitypical cycle, which leads us up to the great Jubilee of restitution. And this we do find. When we multiply the 50th year by the equal number of 50, we get an antitypical cycle of 2,500 years. Although the last year, the 2,500th year itself, is actually part of the antitypical Jubilee, since the great antitypical Jubilee, the great antitype, actually takes the place of the last, or the 50th Jubilee year, in the cycle of 2,500 years. In other words, as we learned in Rule 6, which we reviewed earlier, An antitype does not follow its type when time is an important feature of that type, but rather the antitype replaces the type on the same date. So when we apply this rule, we see that it means that the antitype had to begin at the beginning of a 50th year calculated from the time that Israel entered Canaan. Hence, Earth's Great Jubilee had to begin at the beginning of the 2500th year. Not the beginning of the 2501st year, but the beginning of the 2500th year. Since at no other time at the end of the Great Cycle could the Great Antitype commenced on the same date, the same anniversary date as the typical Jubilee year. Hence we see that, properly speaking, strictly speaking, the antitypical cycle is a full 2,499 years in length. So what are we to do with this? Now that we've found that, precisely speaking, this cycle is 2,499 years, what do we do with it? Well, let's focus on applying it. Let's apply the cycle. Rule number 4 on our list makes the application, we think, perfectly clear and perfectly simple. That is, the great antitypical jubilee, the great antitypical cycle, excuse me, begins to count immediately upon the completion of the celebration of the last typical jubilee year. And so, realizing that, our next task is to find out exactly what was the date that Israel celebrated her last jubilee. Well, we know that during the administration of King Zedekiah, the last king of Israel, that God caused the people of Israel to be taken captive to Babylon, and the land was made completely desolate for a period of 70 years, 70 full years. And since we know that a jubilee year was due to be celebrated sometime during that 70, because it occurred every 50th year, the type must have ceased or passed away prior to the beginning of that 70 years. And based on our study of Bible chronology, we find that the beginning of the year 625 BC marks the precise date that Israel completed its last Jubilee celebration. And hence we believe on this date, 625 BC, at the beginning of the year, the great cycle of 2,499 years began counting. And so when we count 2,499 years from 625 BC, we reach 1,874 full years from AD 1. The Jewish reckoning, we understand, would back us up approximately 3 months to the autumn of 1874. The autumn of 1874 began the grandest time ever known to Earth and to man, Earth's Great Jubilee. Certainly the Jubilee Law is strong enough on its own to sustain these chronological conclusions that we've just reviewed. And you know, if our faith were equally as strong, we wouldn't really need anything further. But our merciful Heavenly Father knew that we would need something additional, and that our faith would need to be buttressed by the testimony of the prophets. And He graciously supplied this need through the mouth of the prophets of old. So what we want to do now is we want to examine 4 key prophecies. And we're going to see that through these 4 key prophecies that God has given us a second independent means of concluding that the autumn of 1874 began Earth's Great Jubilee. Let's start with the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah began prophesying about the time of the administration of King Josiah. And you'll recall that King Josiah was one of the last 5 kings of Israel. And the Lord, through Jeremiah, threatened to desolate the land for 70 years. And we read of this in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 8 to 11, which I believe is cited on your outline. Jeremiah was further caused to declare that the desolation was to be exactly 70 years, no more and no less. The period of desolation was to be exactly 70 years. We read of that in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 10, which is our second prophecy. Thus we see that through these two prophecies in Jeremiah, God gives us the distinct impression that he did not arbitrarily select the number 70, but rather he selected it for a good reason. And that good reason, we believe, is made known unto us in 2 Chronicles, the 36th chapter, verses 17 to 21, which is our third prophecy, where the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy is recorded. God made it clear that 70 Sabbath years must be kept perfectly. That's what he was driving at. When we see the prophet's statement in verse 21, of 2 Chronicles 36, when we look at that carefully, we see that it's precisely in harmony with God's stern warning given through Moses to the children of Israel in our fourth prophecy, which is Leviticus, the 26th chapter, verses 32 to 35. But the question is, when we look at all this, what Sabbath years are we talking about? We saw earlier that there are Sabbath years every seventh year, and then there was the chief Sabbath year during the year of Jubilee. So what years are we talking about, or what years is God talking about? Well, we believe that all of these prophecies show clearly that the Jubilee years, were the ones that God specially wanted kept, because the Jubilee years were the zenith. They were the chief. They were the most important of Israel's Sabbath. Israel didn't have any greater Sabbath than the Jubilee year. And since Israel did not keep them properly, or in some cases they didn't keep them properly, in other cases they didn't keep them at all, God stepped in. And he made sure that Israel would properly keep 70 full Jubilee years by giving the land its complete rest, by desolating it, completely desolating it without an inhabitant for 70 years. But why did God take the time to do this? Why did he take the time to do it with such care and such particularity? Well, apparently by doing so, God was, he was telling us in a covert way that 70 typical Jubilee cycles were to occur between the time that Israel set foot in Canaan and the time of the beginning of the great antitypical Jubilee. And so upon realizing this, that this was his purpose, our task is to calculate the total number of years in 70 prophetic Jubilee cycles. We think that this calculation is easily seen to be 3,449 years. Once we realize that Israel half-heartedly celebrated 19 Jubilees prior to the period of desolation, And the remaining 51, of course, did not even include a Jubilee year because there was none actually celebrated. And we think that the total then of the 19 prior to the period of desolation plus the 51 subsequent to gives us the full measure of 3,449 years. Clearly, what we're saying is a total period of 3,449 years, literal years, were to elapse between the time that Israel set forth in Canaan and the time that the great antitypical Jubilee would commence. Okay, now that we know that the length of this period to be 3,449 years, our next task is to find actually the precise date when the 3,449 years began to count. And this too is actually easy to do. We understand that Israel's Jubilee cycles were to begin once they set foot in Canaan. And from our chronology studies, we learned that Israel crossed the Jordan under the leadership of Joshua and set foot in Canaan in 1575 B.C. And so by simply counting 3,449 years from 1575 B.C., we reach the end of our year 1874. But once again, Jewish reckoning, if we reckon our calculations with the Jewish calendar, it would actually back us up 3 months to the autumn of 1874. The autumn of 1874. Friends, this is precisely the same date that we reached by a totally different method of calculating through the Jubilee law. Certainly our faith in the date 1874 has now got to be shored up. This date must be of divine origin. In no other way could so many numbers and so many prophecies and so many calculations all come together to produce such a united and a harmonious result. And indeed our hearts burn within us as we realize that Jehovah has just spoken to us through the law and through the prophets. But one may well ask, so what? Of what significance is it that we find clearly in Scripture the date 1874 as the beginning of Earth's great jubilee? Of what particular significance is it to us, to you and I, that Earth's great jubilee began in the autumn of 1874? Well, based on the clear testimony of the Scriptures that we have reviewed together, we think it's beyond all respectable controversy that there is no question that the times of restitution are occurring. They will occur. They will accomplish the purpose that God has set forth. And the Scriptures make it equally clear that he who gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time is the chief agent in the restitution work. He is the great restorer. Jesus Christ, we're speaking of, who gave that ransom, is the chief agent in the restitution work. We read in Matthew chapter 18, verse 11, Jesus' own words, where he says that the Son of Man is come to seek and save that which was lost. He's come to save that which was lost. Jesus, without question, is the chief agent, God's chief agent, in this great restitution work. And upon realizing two things, upon realizing that Jesus is God's chief agent in the restitution work, he's God's chief instrument in the restoring work, and upon realizing that the autumn of 1874 commenced the beginning of Earth's great jubilee of restitution, we think that it is reasonable to draw an inference from these two premises that Jesus returned to Earth's atmosphere of influence in the autumn of 1874. But you know, we really don't have to rely on inference to come to this conclusion, because we have the Apostle Peter's inspired statement in the familiar text in Acts chapter 3, verses 19 to 21. And certainly Peter's clear statement in Acts, the third chapter, is clear and concise, and is certainly sufficient for our faith. But you know, we have more. We have Jesus' very own statement in Matthew, the 12th chapter, verse 8. Matthew 12, 8, where he says that the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. Earth's great jubilee of restitution is the Sabbath day, which began in the autumn of 1874. Thus Jesus declared many years ago, he himself declared that he would return in the autumn of 1874. Friends, our hearts leap for joy knowing that our beloved Master is not en route. He's not on the way. He's not coming. Friends, he's here. He's already arrived. But we wish to remember one thing. Jesus didn't return just for the sake of returning, but rather he returned to accomplish several important works. When Jesus was yet here upon the earth as a man, he taught us in the familiar verses of Matthew, the 13th chapter, and we're particularly looking at verses 30 and 39, that the harvest is the end of the age. And he further suggested that the harvest has two features to it. The first that he mentions is the binding of the tares in bundles and the destruction thereof in the fire, so as to make the field ready for the crop of the new age, which we understand would be the restitution class. But the second feature that he mentioned, the second feature of the harvest, was the gathering of the wheat into the heavenly barn. John the Revelator, in Revelation chapter 14, verse 14, indicates that the exalted Jesus returns as the chief reaper. Thus we conclude that a second item of significance to our conclusion that the times of restitution commenced in the autumn of 1874 was that the autumn of 1874 also began, it marked the beginning of the date of the commencement of the gospel age harvest and also of the gospel age harvest work. We could actually say a lot more about the harvest, about the gospel harvest we're speaking, but time is really not going to permit us to do so now. Our main purpose in introducing the subject of the harvest was simply to briefly offer a scriptural connection between the return of our Lord in the autumn of 1874 and the commencement of the gospel harvest. Before delving into our fifth and final section of our remarks, I'd like to tell you a little story that was told to me. This old meteorologist who was off the coast of Maine had been forecasting the weather for many years. Finally came time when he was getting ready to retire. And the company that he worked for decided they'd better bring in a young fellow to be his understudy for a while because the old fellow had gained a lot of wisdom and experience that they thought to make the transition easier, that it would be good to have the older fellow impart this wisdom to the younger. And so they did. They brought a fellow in who worked for about a month as the old fellow's understudy. Finally, the last day of work came for the old man. And he went up to the young fellow and he said, "I've given you a lot of wisdom, given you a lot of tips, a lot of pointers that I've picked up over the years. But," he said, "there's one last bit of wisdom I'd like to give you. Before you issue the weather forecast, be sure that you first look outside." No consideration of the subject of the times of restitution would be complete without our figuratively looking out the window to see whether the evidence seen, does it support or does it militate against the conclusion that the times of restitution have commenced. So let us round out our consideration of the subject by taking a look outside. And let's observe whether there are any evidences that the times of restitution have indeed begun. You know, up to this point, we've said almost nothing about our title, The Silver Trumpets. In fact, you've probably thought that we've forgotten all about our title. But really, this isn't the case. We want to return one last time to the title. And we think that there might be some additional lessons that we can gain from that. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 9, shows quite clearly that the first day of the Jubilee year was also Israel's Day of Atonement. And we recall from our studies of Leviticus, the 9th and the 16th chapters particularly, that Israel's Day of Atonement was full of activities, full of sacrifices and related activities. And undoubtedly it took most of the day of atonement to accomplish these. And at the end of that day, we believe, the priest sounded the glorious Jubilee trumpets, the silver trumpets, proclaiming liberty to the people. But how did this sound emanate throughout all the land? We're told in verse 9 that the sound was to emanate throughout the land. But how was it done? Certainly one trumpet was not sufficient to carry this message throughout the land. There were certainly no electronic amplifiers. There was no radio. There was no TV. So how was it done? How did this message emanate throughout all the land? We believe that it was done by the people themselves. And it was done by them throughout all the land by the use of ram horns. As soon as the people closest to the silver trumpets, closest to the priests, I should say, heard the sounding of the silver trumpets, they would echo this sound on their ram's horns. And the people further away, upon hearing those ram's horns, would repeat the sound on their own ram's horns. And pretty soon, through this process, we can see how the message would emanate throughout all the land. By this process, really, in a very short order, the people throughout all the land were awakened to their rights under the law. They were awakened by the sounding of the silver trumpets. But what's the significance of this? What's the significance of the fact that we have two different groups of people blowing on two different kinds of horns? We have priests blowing on silver trumpets. We have others blowing on ram's horns. Well, silver, we understand, represents truth, God's glorious truth. And especially since our Lord's return, the truth, His truth, has been revealed such as never before to the footstep followers of the Master. The sanctuary has been cleansed, and the vessels of truth have been uncovered from the overlying rubble that was placed upon them during the Dark Ages. And they've been returned in all of their beauty and all of their brilliance to the sanctuary through the messengers to the churches. And particularly do we appreciate the messenger to the Laodicean church. Friends, you and I are privileged to see God's glorious plan for man. We have been enlightened. And it's our privilege and it's our duty to blow the silver trumpets, to proclaim the message of radiant kingdom truths throughout all the land, as much as and as long as we can. Friends, we should be binding up the broken hearts. We should be proclaiming liberty to the captives on every available opportunity, to every ear that is a hearing ear. And the presence, we believe, of this great privilege of being enlightened and of having the privilege of blowing on the silver trumpets, we believe that this is an indisputable evidence that the times of restitution of all things has indeed commenced. But what of those who blew on the ram's horns? Who are they? And what do they represent? What are they proclaiming? We answer that we believe that these, the ones who blew on the ram's horns, represent the common ones. They represent the people at large, the common ones. And if we carefully observe the type on this particular point, we find yet another striking evidence that the times of restitution of all things have begun. The very first work of restitution, we believe, is properly a breaking down of the old systems of error, inequity, and unrighteousness. For example, if someone came up to you and I and contracted with us to go out and build a new building out on a building lot that already had an old building standing upon it, what would we first have to do? We're contracted to build the new building, but there's an old one sitting on the building. It's in the way. We would properly first, our first step would have to be to bring down the old building, the old decaying structure, before we could commence the construction of the new. When we examine the actual operation, now we're looking now at the operation of the Jubilee Law, we find that this particular point, we think, is beautifully contained. In response to their hearing the silver trumpets, the people blew on their ram's horns, as we've already mentioned. And undoubtedly, their general enlightenment led them to demand their rights, their liberties, and their possessions, everything to which they were entitled. Unquestionably, they would demand it at that point. And because of their enlightenment, and because of their consequent demands, and undoubtedly, we have no doubt that they probably made some excessive demands for their rights, not being perfect men. But as a result of these demands, we believe that the old inequities which had accumulated over the prior 49 years since the last typical Jubilee had been celebrated. We believe that all these old inequities were destroyed. They were brought down. Their demands for their rights led to much commotion and disturbance at first, since the demands often met, probably, with resistance by the recalcitrant landowners, who probably were not so willing to surrender their expired claims. But how perfectly we see the operation of this feature, and how perfectly the operation of this feature of the Jubilee Law describes the world situation since the autumn of 1874. The sounding of the Jubilee trump of knowledge and liberty has awakened the people, and as a result, they're blowing not on the silver trumpets, they're blowing on ram's horns. They're not proclaiming God's truths, because the fact of the matter is they really know very little of God's truths when we look out the window. But rather, they're blowing on their ram's horns. They're shouting for their rights. They're demanding reforms of all kinds. Reforms on account of the gross inequities that have accumulated over the years. Friends, their demands, there's many demands. Demands for tenants' rights. Rights for the handicapped. You know, did you ever notice anymore when you go to cross the sidewalk, there's a little plate there for wheelchairs? A few years ago, I never noticed any of those, but you see them now. Rights for the handicapped. Rights for the environment. Rights even for the dumb animals we see. Even our legislatures are adopting statutes to protect the dumb animals. The animals don't have a voice. Or do they? We believe that we're in the time when the gross inequities that have been perpetrated even against the dumb animals, the oppressive practices, are coming down. Workers' rights. Rights for pure food. Friends, the list goes on and on and on. And all of these, we believe, evidence that the old oppressive practices, the old inequities, the gross unrighteousness that has been perpetrated for years, is being destroyed. But you may ask, aside from the operation of the law that you've just referred to, can you give us any scriptures? Can you give us any scriptures suggesting that the demands for reforms and for rights that are going on all about us, and the destruction of the present evil, are evidences of the beginning of the times of restitution? Because contention and commotion were clearly not required by the Jubilee Law. The Jubilee Law did not require that they have contention and commotion. Friends, this was a result of the operation of the Jubilee Law. This certainly wasn't something they were required under the Law of Moses to have. And so you may ask, can anything so incidental as the operation of the Mosaic Law, the Jubilee Law, can anything so incidental have some antitypical meaning? Well, we believe that it does. In answer to this question, we find that the Apostle Paul really gives us the authority to make the connection between the beginning of the times of restitution and commotion and contention and the demanding of rights and the bringing down of the old order. We're referring to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 16, where Paul speaks of, quote, the trump of God, unquote. Paul clearly associates this trump with a shout and with the Lord's return. And the Greek word translated shout here is the word kalousma, which implies a shout of encouragement. Now, what do we see when we look out the window figuratively. When we look out the window, we see men encouraging each other and being encouraged by the increase of knowledge to wake up to and to demand their rights. And we believe that Paul taught us to expect trouble and anger and commotion and demands during the early stages of our Lord's return, which is marked by the sounding of the trump of God, to which he makes reference. Paul taught us to expect these things, and we believe that when we look out the window, we find these things. Friends, we believe that what we see are the effects of the sounding of the trump of God. So based on Paul's thought in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 16, trouble and commotion and demands for rights amongst men are clear evidences of the beginning of the sounding of the Jubilee trumpets. And although time is really not going to permit us to make a study, or really not going to permit us to examine the matter in great detail, we would invite you to make a study of four trumpets that are referred to in Scripture. One is the one we've just made mention to, the Levitical trumpet. Levitical trumpets in Leviticus, the 25th chapter. The second is the last trump, referred to by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 52. 1 Corinthians 15, 52. Next, the seventh angel, or trumpet, referred to in Revelation, the 11th chapter, verses 15 through 18. So we have the four. We have the Jubilee trumpet, the last trump in 1 Corinthians 4:15, the seventh trumpet or angel in Revelation 11, and the trump of God, which we've just reviewed in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Friends, we believe that when we look out the window, we see a wealth of evidence that verifies the accuracy of the present day forecast. The present day forecast, friends, which is found in the Jubilee arrangement. We see the silver trumpets, and we see the ram's horns being blown. In summary, when we stop to see just how imperfect things are, how bad a situation the world is truly in, how much suffering, how much sickness, how much pain, how much hatred, how much unrighteousness and inequity. When we look out and we see all these things, how fallen is man? It's no wonder that at times we may second guess our belief in the entire concept of the restitution of all things and of the times of restitution of all things. And not only that, but our faith may falter in realizing that we're in the times of restitution of all things. When we look out and we see how bad things really are, the whole concept of restitution, it just seems so impossible. It seems like there is so much to do, it just seems like it's just not possible. I'm sure most of us, if not all of us, have had these thoughts of doubt enter our minds from time to time. And we know that part of the proper antidote when we have these thoughts of doubt is the refreshing of water by the Word. And so that we thought that by reviewing with you the Jubilee Law, the Jubilee Prophecies, the significance of both, as well as the evidence of each one, should help to restore our faith in this all-pervasive theme of the Bible. Hopefully, by sharing these thoughts together, our faith in the times of restitution, not just that we're in it, not just that chronologically it has begun, but in the character features as well, and that it will be truly the times of restitution of all things. Hopefully these thoughts that we have shared together will be an anchor to our soul, both sure and steadfast to the end. May these few thoughts help us to be faithful, not just to the end of our present walk, but for all eternity. We would ask the Lord's overruling forgiveness for anything suggested or thought which is amiss.